We want the regime in Pyongyang to permanently abandon its nuclear and ballistic missile programs and ambitions.
North Korean missiles highlight the first 100 days for the new South Korean president. It's Friday, August 18th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, diplomacy remains the top strategy in Korea. Hong Kong activists are jailed. India seeks to deport refugees, fixing embryo genes and then giving them science books. It's all on today's VOA Asia. South Korean President Moon Jae-in Thursday marked his 100th day in office, expressing confidence there will be no war on the Korean Peninsula. He said he has been assured the United States will discuss any options it may make with South Korea. However, Mr. Moon warned Pyongyang's development of intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads could mark the crossing of a red line. The South Korean leader also said he believes dialogue with the North is possible if it halts nuclear and missile testing. His comments come a week before the United States and South Korea begin annual military exercises, in the past strongly criticized by North Korea as a prelude to invasion. Mr. Moon's remarks came 2 days after leader Kim Jong-un pulled back from threatened missile tests in waters around the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam. President Donald Trump tweeted Wednesday it was a wise and well-reasoned decision. Vice President Mike Pence spoke of it during a visit to Chile.
As the president did today, we welcome the statements of the Kim regime this week with regard to Guam. But our objective is clear. It is a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. And we want the regime in Pyongyang to permanently abandon its nuclear and ballistic missile programs and ambitions. And we'll continue to bring pressure to bear till we achieve that goal.
Pence said while all options, including military action, remain active, he said economic and diplomatic pressure being brought to bear on the North offers glimmers of hope. He called on Chile, Mexico, Brazil, and Peru to break all diplomatic and commercial ties with Pyongyang. Wednesday, Ukraine ordered an investigation into a report that a Ukrainian factory may have sold Soviet-era rocket engines to the North on the black market. Tuesday, the factory and the Kiev government denied providing it any defense technology. Korea Economic Institute official Troy Stangerone tells VOA's Victor Beatty an investigation is warranted to determine if the North now has the capability of producing these engines on its own.
If this is something to where all North Korea was able to get was the plans and they've determined how to take and develop and produce the missile engines on their own, you have a situation to where, as you say, the cat is out of the bag and there's not much we can probably do. If this is a situation to where they were able to procure a few engines and those engines are all they have, and they haven't actually been able to reverse engineer the technology, this is something to where you could potentially take and stop them and limit their progress. So I think finding out which of the two it is important.
Troy, President Trump tweeted on Wednesday that Kim Jong-un made a wise decision in not firing missiles toward the waters of Guam. He called it well-reasoned. He said the alternative would have been both catastrophic and unacceptable. Are we to suggest that this might be an opening for some sort of dialogue?
I think we need to find a way to get to dialogue at some point. Whether Trump acting magnanimous and Kim Jong-un not taking and following through on the test that he suggested they might do, is that opening or not, is still questionable. We have the U.S.-South Korean exercises coming up starting next Monday. Kim Jong-un has said that he's going to watch what we do. My guess is that at the minimum, we'll see some more heated rhetoric from North Korea during the exercises. But the question becomes, once those exercises concluded, assuming North Korea doesn't conduct another test, how do we then take and move what might be some open political space into talks?
These missiles, if they are fired toward waters around Guam, would necessarily have a trajectory near or over Japan. And the United States has indicated it's prepared to down any missiles that threaten U.S. territory. Perhaps is this a bridge too far and Kim Jong-un has decided to take a step back?
This is a situation that Kim Jong-un, I think, is playing very carefully. He is very much trying to take and, one, test the limits of President Trump, but at the same time also not do anything that would endanger the regime. In terms of the potential attack towards Guam, I think it was something clearly designed to respond, rhetorically speaking, to President Trump's comments of fire and fury, which seemed to come, you know, relatively speaking, out of nowhere. And that being said, I question whether, beyond rhetoric, North Korea actually intended to ever follow through on this threat, but instead try to take and show that President Trump, that they can go toe-to-toe in terms of strong rhetoric as well.
Speaking Thursday in China, the senior U.S. military official, Marine General Joseph Dunford, said a military solution to the North Korean threat would be horrific, but allowing Pyongyang to develop a nuclear missile capability threatening the U.S. is unimaginable. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. Top U.S. general meets Chinese President Xi to discuss North Korean threat. United States says joint South Korea war games not on the negotiating table. Rights activists call on India not to deport Rohingyas, but solve issue. Pakistan slams United States for declaring anti-India Kashmir group as terrorist. Education activist Malala Yousafzai to study at Oxford. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia and at our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. South Korean President Moon Jae-in on Thursday said he has received assurances from U.S. President Donald Trump that Washington would not launch any attack against North Korea without Seoul's approval. The liberal Moon was elected to office in May following the impeachment of conservative President Park Geun-hye, who was ousted from office for her alleged involvement in a multi-million-dollar corruption scandal. In contrast to his predecessor, who had carefully scripted responses to pre-approved questions during news conferences, Moon answered spontaneously, but still carefully avoided potential areas of disagreement with the United States. President Moon has advocated for reducing tensions on the Korean Peninsula through dialogue and engagement in what seems to be a sharp difference in tone and emphasis to President Trump's fire and fury confrontational rhetoric and maximum pressure policy that stresses the possible use of force to prevent North Korea from developing nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles. President Moon has a fine line to walk, says John DeLurie, international relations professor at Yonsei University in Seoul.
President Moon's position is delicate. He does not want to come out and show some kind of gap with his ally, with the United States, even when President Trump is using escalatory language and talking about war options that are totally inimical to the interests of the vast majority of South Koreans.
The president has focused on areas of agreement. That North Korea must be stopped from developing a fully functioning ICBM capability, increasing economic pressure on North Korea as the primary means to force Pyongyang to agree to denuclearization talks, and voicing support for strong military deterrence. President Moon called unprecedented the recently increased UN sanctions that ban the export of North Korean coal and other key minerals, and that could deprive the Kim regime of up to $1 billion a year to fuel its illicit nuclear and ballistic missile program. The South Korean president did not specifically mention the United States-South Korea joint military exercises scheduled for next week that North Korea has in the past condemned as, quote, rehearsals for invasion. You'll find much more on our website at voanews.com as the story continues to develop. Our thanks to Brian Padden and our VOA correspondent in Seoul, and Yuumi Kim, for sending us this report. Happening now in Asia, the United States top general says the United States and South Korea will proceed with joint military drills next week, resisting pressure from China and North Korea to halt the annual exercises. In Beijing, Marine General Joseph Dunford says the United States has no plans to curtail military exercises. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. A Hong Kong appeals court has sentenced three young leaders of the city's pro-democracy movement to prison. Joshua Wong, Nathan Law, and Alex Cho initially received non-custodial sentences by a lower court last year for storming a courtyard on the grounds of the government's headquarters in September 2014. Joshua Wong, the face of the protest movement, was sentenced to 6 months in prison. Nathan Law and Alex Cho were given 8 and 7 months, respectively. The sentencing is seen as a severe setback for the semi-autonomous Chinese city and its struggle for greater political freedom under Communist Party rule. The sentences risked casting the three young men as Hong Kong's first prisoners of conscience, undermining the city's reputation as a haven of civil liberties with special status in China. After the sentences were announced, Mr. Wong posted a series of defiant messages on Twitter, saying he would not give up his fight for democracy. All three were immediately taken into custody. They all intend to appeal their sentences, according to Lester Shum, a fellow protest leader who read a statement outside of the court. Albert Ho is the former chairman of Hong Kong's Democratic Party. He spoke with VOA's Sarah Williams.
But to start with, we are very disappointed by the decision of the Court of Appeal increasing the sentence of these three young activists by imposing an immediate custodial sentence, although they have already served social service, a community service order after the sentencing, the passing of the sentence in the first-level magistracy court. We are particularly outraged by the government's policy in seeking to oppress the social movement by taking the matter to the Court of Appeal, while knowing that the first instance magistrate took a sympathetic view to this social activist by telling them that, okay, they are giving a rather lenient sentence, but want them not to commit this offense again. So I think the government is seeking to take the matter to the High Court in order to get a heavy sentence, causing a deterrent effect on the activists in Hong Kong, particularly the young activists. This is very discouraging and will have a lot of inhibiting effect on those people who seek to join the social movement for democracy.
Now, have all three, are they under arrest? Are they in prison now, or will they appeal the sentence?
Now, they have already been taken to prison, okay, immediately. They have made it very clear that they would take the matter to the Court of Final Appeal. But I think that will take some time before the case is heard. So I think their legal representatives will try to get them bail pending appeal. Otherwise, by the time when the case is heard before the Court of Final Appeal, they would have already served the sentence. But be that as it may, I think they would still like to take the matter to the Court of Final Appeal in order to seek a proper exposition of the sentencing policy. I think the Court of Appeal is wrong in principle. Firstly, to sentence a person for a second time by in taking him to prison, knowing that the defendant has already completed the service of the sentence, okay, by the court of the first level. And secondly, I think it is too harsh to impose such a heavy sentence for first offenders, especially knowing that these people have a lofty motive. They have no selfish interest of their own to serve, and they are simply fighting for a more just society and also seeking to promote democracy against the situation when Hong Kong's people's rights have been deprived. People's rights to democratic election has been deprived. So it is wrong for the Court of Appeal to totally ignore all this lofty motive of the young people.
Albert Ho, former chairman of Hong Kong's Democratic Party, speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams. When British rule ended 20 years ago, Hong Kong was seen as a rare blend of East and West that China might seek to emulate. In a statement issued late Thursday, the Hong Kong Department of Justice defended its appeal for tougher sentencing as its legal right, adding that the three protest leaders were, quote, convicted not because they exercised their civil liberties, but because their conduct during the protest contravened the law. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, a 10-year-old rape victim in India who was denied permission to have an abortion has given birth to a girl. The baby was delivered by cesarean section a month after the Indian Supreme Court denied an abortion request. The child was allegedly repeatedly raped by her uncle, who has been arrested. Top stories and great features are found every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, human rights groups are calling on India to take a lead in addressing the crisis faced by tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees who have fled Myanmar after a senior minister said New Delhi plans to identify and deport those living in the country. Junior Home Minister Kiran Rijiju described them as an illegal immigrants and security threat and said India will send back an estimated 40,000 refugees, regardless of the fact that some 16,500 are registered with the United Nations. The statement in Parliament brought immediate expressions of concern by the United Nations and rights activists. The spokesman for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said refugees should not be returned to countries where they fear persecution. Outside Parliament, New Delhi has been tight-lipped on the sensitive issue and has not offered any specifics on how and where it will deport the refugees who escaped alleged killings and persecution in Myanmar. South Asia Director of Human Rights Watch, Meenakshi Ganguly, is dismayed by talks that India says it's having with Bangladesh and Myanmar on the deportation plan.
If they say that they want to talk to Myanmar and Bangladesh to resolve the Rohingya issue, that is very welcome. If they're going to say they're going to talk to them merely to deport 40,000 desperate people, that is really, really shocking.
New Delhi says it is not a signatory to the Accord on Refugees, but rights activists say India must abide by international obligations and point out that a number of refugees in India is far smaller than in neighboring Bangladesh. The United Nations Refugee Agency in New Delhi says it has not received any official communication from the government about deportations, and there are no reported instances of deportations of registered Rohingya so far. The issue has come under the spotlight ahead of a scheduled visit by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to Myanmar next month. Ganguly of Human Rights Watch says the Rohingya issue needs a long-term solution.
India, as an important player in the region, also has a very strong voice and should now be using that to solve this.
However, political analysts in New Delhi, like South Asia expert at the Institute of Defense Studies and Analyses, Sukh Deomuni, say the contentious issue is not likely to figure at a high level, as Modi's main objective is to build ties with a country where China has an influence.
Well, I think India has gone a bit more cautious. Probably some mechanism has been worked out to get the Rohingyas back and through mutual consultation. Of course, they don't want to go because they feel more secure here.
South Asia Director of Human Rights Watch, Meenakshi Ganguly, says the treatment of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya in Myanmar has emerged as a contentious human rights issue as the country makes a transition from decades of harsh military rule to democracy.
This new government under Aung San Suu Kyi is obviously under a lot of pressure from the military, but it cannot subscribe to the same sort of racist principles that was used by the military.
Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has been criticized for not speaking out more about the problem, even as the military conducts operations against Rohingya militants that have resulted in widespread claims of human rights abuses. The government has denied the allegations. We thank Anjana Pasricha, who provided this story from New Delhi. Developing at this hour in Asia, three prominent young leaders of Hong Kong's democracy movement were sentenced Thursday to 6 to 8 months in prison, a severe setback for the semi-autonomous Chinese city in its struggle for greater political freedom under Communist Party rule. Check out all the day's stories and features on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a study published this month in the online scientific journal Nature stunned the world as scientists were able to fix a hereditary genetic mutation in a human embryo. The milestone achievement was quickly tempered by the ethical question, will this lead to making designer babies? VOA's George Pudich explains.
One thing scientists say is very clear. Using gene editing on humans is still a long way off because we do not know what happens when an embryo with edited genes actually grows into a person.
These are some big unknowns that it'll take years to understand, and we're not really ready for this to get launched. The ethics, the unknowns are really, really big questions.
After the failure of similar attempts in China, scientists at Oregon Health and Science University used a different approach, trying to repair a faulty gene in a human embryo at the moment of fertilization. Sperm from a male donor that scientists knew were carrying a mutated gene which causes a hereditary heart disease were inserted into human egg cells together with a molecule that serves as genetic scissors directed at the faulty gene in the male DNA.
So DNA is a kind of long string, and these molecular scissors would cut where the mutation is.
Out of 58 fertilized eggs, the cut was repaired in 42 of them that continued to grow without the faulty gene. The experiments were stopped when the embryos grew to only 8 cells.
If you look at the 8 cells, every cell would have perfectly the same repair.
The experiment showed that if gene editing is done at an early stage, the cells can repair the cuts and continue to grow without disease-carrying genes that have plagued families for generations. But it is not yet known whether the embryos with edited DNA would grow into healthy humans. Current U.S. laws do not allow clinical experiments on humans, but other countries have less stringent regulations. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
Well, once they're born, reading to children is one of the best ways to prepare them for a lifetime of learning. It introduces babies to language and teaches youngsters about color, shapes, and letters. But an Australian quantum physicist is experimenting with something different. As VOA reporter Faiza El-Masri found out, it's colleague Faith Lapidus who tells us he's writing science books for babies and toddlers.
A personal experience motivated Chris Ferry to begin writing science books for these young readers.
He was in a bookstore for books for my kids and kind of naturally gravitated to the science section and noticed, well, there really isn't a science section for babies.
His books cover scientific concepts and topics for children from infancy to 10 years old in language they can understand. The Sydney-based physicist says his goal is to cultivate a passion for science in young kids.
In the Great Green Lab, there was a laser and a lab notebook.
Ferry believes it's never too early to introduce children to science and technology.
At any point in time, going to be closer to a piece of technology than they are going to be to an animal or the topics that exist in children's books today. So I think it's more relevant to them.
That's true, says researcher Christine Preston, who focuses on the role of science in early education.
But we also need to understand that young children think quite laterally and they need to be exposed to all manner of things that are going on in society.
A picture of Einstein.
Chris Ferry hopes his books will not only introduce young children to science, but will inspire them to become scientists. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Fascinating stuff. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We invite you to get our program in many different ways. If for some reason you can't listen in the current form you're listening to, you can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud, download us as a podcast, and take VOA Asia wherever you go. You can find us at VOA Asia Facebook, also a great place to get in touch with us if you like. Or you could send us a, quote, traditional email. VOA Asia at voanews.com is the place to write to. We'd also like to say hello to everybody listening in Quezon City, Philippines, DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines in Diliman. Thanks so much for spending time with us today. We're glad to have you with us. We're also always glad to have our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, managing editor, Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Bird as part of our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.